This presentation is from Service Design 2012, held in Melbourne in May. For more presentations from this and other conferences, please visit uxaustralia.com.au.
Hi everybody, welcome. Good to be here. Couldn't make it last year, and you probably want to know, I'm a business guy, sitting here talking about the discipline of design. Every week or two, I get a phone call from somebody who rings up and says, hey, seen you on Proto Partners, seen you at Thinks and Drinks, and we'd just like to come and talk to you about service design. So they come out, one of the first questions they ask is, I've read your sort of background, you're a business guy. How the hell did you get into actually this business? And it was accidental, not intentional. I did a marketing degree. And then I worked for a company called National Foods, which designed and developed a whole bunch of national milk brands like Kura Milk. I worked there for 5 years. I then moved on to Foster's, Carlton United Breweries. I was the marketing manager of Foster's and Foster's Light Ice and Cascade, had a wow of a time. After that, I worked at Telstra for 2 years, which was an interesting experiment. My wife got a job in America. Via Barbados. I lived in Barbados for a few months, and then we moved to America, and I worked for a company called Diageo. And anybody who drinks probably would have imbibed one of their products. So it's Johnny Walker, Tanqueray, Guinness. So I did that for 3 years. And at the end of that, I was always wanted to own my own business. And I'd thought about brand strategy, hadn't quite got there. We moved back from New York because we were living in a one-bedroom apartment, and we wanted to have children. And we got back, and I also had this other love, this other itch that I had to scratch, and it was advertising. And I'd been to work experience in advertising when I was 14, 16, and 18, and I just really wanted to run or work in an advertising agency. So I got a job at Young & Rubicam, working on the Telstra account for my sins, and did that for about 5 years to the point where I ended up running, you know, a really large team looking after the Telstra advertising account. And they're one of the hardest taskmasters in the world. If anybody's worked with Telstra, they kill you. But you learn a lot about service. So I did that for about 5 years, ended up running an ad agency, working in a bunch of associated marketing services companies. And towards the end, I knew my time in advertising was coming to an end. So I started planning to get out. Because if you don't, somebody will go and whack you anyway, because that's what happens in advertising. So I started to plan. I met up with a friend who used to work as a competitor, and I've been in innovation all my life. We've developed lots of new products, lots of new innovation. I've been reading about design and design thinking for 2 or 3 years, pulling down articles in preparation for a new life. And I found the whole thing totally fascinating. We started our business, Proto Partners, in June 2008, myself and a business partner. And 3 months later, the GFC hit. We had revenue at the time, but revenue just stopped, dead, in October 2008. In December 2008, we had our second child. My wife wasn't working, we had two children at home, and we had no revenue coming in the door. And somebody had said when we started our business, and it was mainly a product innovation business, we were doing some work with Schweppes and Qantas, and we were doing some good stuff, but it all just stopped. They said, think about service innovation. I went, oh, yeah, whatever. But I came to a point where I came back after December with two children, no revenue, and a big mortgage, and wondered what I was going to do. So came back to work in January, started scouring the net, and remembered this thing about service innovation. Started Googling service innovation. And within an hour, I came across service design. I'd never bloody heard of it. But what the hell is this? I read a book, I downloaded a book, it was called Journey to the Interface. Some of you may have read it by Joe Heapy and somebody else, written in Europe as an 80-page ebook, all about service design and social service design. I downloaded it, sat in a beanbag at my office, read it from cover to cover, 80 pages, and thought, wow, this is amazing. This is so great. This is what the world needs. I am going to get into this. So I rang my wife and I said, darling, I know what we're going to do. And she said, what are we going to do? And I said, we're getting into the service design business. And she said, the service what? I said, the service design business. She said, okay, if you say so. For the next 2 months, I downloaded hundreds, if not thousands, of articles on design, design thinking, services. I devoured as many of them as I could. There was no process. There was no service design process. There was no book you could go to understand how to do this. We had approached product innovation through a design thinking approach, so we had some sense of it. But as you would know, it's totally different. So what we had to do, what I had to do, was actually build a methodology out of, you know, those hundreds and thousands of articles. I downloaded gigabytes of information, and I put it together. I approached one of my friends who runs a private equity fund. One of his investments was Contours Ladies Gyms. It's a 30-minute female gym for women. And I said, well, listen, I'm in this business, I'm doing this thing, I have a methodology, but I don't know if it works. All the case studies overseas say it works, but I don't know, and I need to prove it. Will you let me into your business for 2 months, pro bono, and see if this thing works? So for 2 months, I pulled the methodology and the process together, we implemented it, and it worked. It was wonderful. I didn't have any money to do anything with it, but I had a working case study. I knew that it worked and had a belief. And so from then, we went on to get lots of other clients. So that's how I got into the service design business. It was accidental, it wasn't intentional. But being here now, I never want to go anywhere else. I love this like a fat kid loves chocolate cake. This is fantastic. I was, a quick apology, Eric Roscoe Mabbing, my partner in crime, was supposed to be with me. As it turns out, he couldn't make it. So I'm on my own today. So if you're expecting to see this Dutch guy here, he's not here. But next time. As I say, I love design and I love business. I love, when I found out about the form and function of design, and all you guys would know all about that, I just thought it was fantastic. I had to learn about it, because I'm not a trained designer. I'm just a business guy with a great love of design. My first exposure to design really was these guys. And everybody knows about these guys. But this stuff works. It's beautiful. Also, the way that a Mercedes car door closes is beautiful. If anyone's ever sat in one of those Aeron chairs, it's beautifully designed. An Ames chair, you never want another one. They're fantastic. I love design. The other thing, and given we're here at a service design conference, is to talk about not products, but designing experiences. And if anyone's ever been to a Cirque du Soleil concert, you'll know what I mean. You walk in there, there's all these things happening. There's clowns walking around, there's music going on. It all seems spontaneous. But you know what? Every single thing that you see there is engineered. It's premeditated. From the time you walk in to when you walk down to the gate, when you walk in to buy a drink, when you come back to your seat, when the clowns are romping around, it's all thought through. Every single thing. It's all intentional. And so what we're about is combining and making intentional experiences that create enormous value for organisations. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. And even if you do nothing with us, I want you to think of your world this way. So why? Why do we need this? Why do we need design and business? We know more companies are taking a customer-centred approach. That is not new. Everyone's talking about it, but you're also talking about, there's all these blogs and articles about how do I prove to my boss that we should do this? Or even if we've done it, how do we actually prove that we've actually created value? We've done all this great stuff. We've invested lots of time and resources. We know it's intuitively right, but we can't prove it. And that's one of the problems. So how do we actually move upon from just knowing it's right to proving it's right? It's important now because our world has never been so complex. It was really simple 20, 30 years ago. There was no need for service design 20 or 30 years ago. The world was a lot simpler pace. But the world is super complex now. It's super involved, it's super networked, and it needs the skills that we have in this room to actually break that down and make sense of it all. It needs the skills of designers to understand that empathy, understanding the customers, but it also needs the design of business to actually bring that to life. There's nobody really doing this in large part at the moment. There's packets of it, but this isn't a wholesale thought. I know people are thinking about this a little bit, but there's nobody doing it really, really well on a large scale across the world. So the logical question is, why isn't this happening? Why aren't we putting design and business together the way it should go together? And I think it's this. Designers have a tendency to want to start from scratch. And that's okay. I understand that. I work with the designers, my team and I, they're brilliant at what they do. But designers have a tendency to want to start from scratch. But if you think about it, designers went to school. They spent 4 years understanding, learning an approach. They codify the approach, and what it allowed them to do is develop repeatable and sustainable outcomes. So that's what designers do. And if you think about it a little bit more, being a designer is just like being a filmmaker. When you go to a film, everything you see is totally premeditated before you actually see it. The film was written, it was crafted, it was produced, it was recut, it was shaped, it was reshaped, it was recut, it was re-edited, until you see what you see on the screen. Now, I know when you go to the screen, you don't want to understand or think about what happens behind the scenes. That destroys the whole thing. But that's what's happening. So it's pretty similar to what sort of designers do. And I think this is why. When you go to a magic show, you don't want to think about, you just want to enjoy the magic. You don't want to understand how the magic happens. Because when you do that, it takes away the enjoyment of the magic that you've just been looking at. But you know what? If you want to be serious in business, if you want to be serious in the service business and the service design business, you have to understand that magic. And you have to be able to master that magic and codify it to create repeatable, sustainable, value-creating outcomes. I think one of the other reasons is there isn't that variety of skills or experience all in one place. You've got service, you've got designers who come from a design background. You've got customer experience guys who come from a business background. And they're both very good at what they do. But the issue is, if you just have designers working on this, you will be 100% effective at solving 50% of the problem. At first, design and business don't seem to gel together. They come from very, very different worlds. They come from very, very different approaches. Design is outside in. Business is inside out. Put the two together, oil and water. It doesn't work. But it does if you persist. I remember a time just over a year ago. It was Easter Friday. We're working on one of our clients. The reason we're working Easter Friday is not because I'm a maniac or anything like that, but Eric was out from Europe for a week and we needed to utilise all the time. We had all the business commercial analysts, we had all the designers, we were all in our office on Easter Friday working through some things. And we almost had a stand-up fight. I mean, it was almost at fisticuffs. We were swearing at each other, there were F-bombs going, well, we were pointing at each other and accusing. It was really, really painful. And if anybody is, you know, most of you are familiar with that forming, storming, norming, performing. How do teams form? They form, they storm, they fight, they norm, they understand how they work with each other, and then they perform. And what we were doing together at that time was bringing together all these people. And at the time, they weren't full-time employees. They were sort of bringing all these agents together that we work with, but to all in one place to actually bear on a huge client problem. So it's hard. It's actually hard to get people who respect each other. If you're a designer, you respect the business guys. That actually looking through a spreadsheet and uncovering meaning from that is really powerful and it's really cool. And the going out there and sitting in people's living rooms and listening to what they say and maybe listening for that one magic phrase, that's equally cool. And guess what? Those two things can work together. Then the one's not better or worse, but they're better together. So what we're about today and what I want to talk to you about today is, how do you create value for the organisation? How do you create value for the customer? Quick definition, and if we're talking about vision and value, and today is about how do you transform vision into value, customer experience vision into, you know, tangible business value. What's a vision? It outlines what an organisation wants to be or how it wants the world to be or how it wants the world it wants to operate in. It's emotive, it's long-term, it's visionary. If you were to take an example for a company or an NGO or something working with poverty, it would be a world without poverty. It would be something you could aspire to. And it's great. And we've all got visions and they're really important. Absolutely important. And it's not that having a vision is wrong, it's just that it's not enough. We need to understand the other part of the equation. It's about value. Yep, the value we're talking about is strategic, operational, financial value for organisations. It's intangible value, it's intangible value. It's about monetary value, it's about non-monetary value. It's about all the value that you can create around an organisation. So the four things I want to talk about today are asking the right question. If you don't ask the right question, don't stop looking for the right question, start looking for the right, stop looking for the right answer, start looking for the right question. I want to talk about jobs. I want to talk about how to measure value and also talk about jobs and how you can create new value. I want to talk about reducing complexity and why reducing complexity is important, put a hopefully different spin on it. And I want to talk about keeping promises, because that's how you create value. A focus on asking the right question only yields understanding of customers at a surface level. Most traditional market research operates at that level. If you ask customers at a conscious level, they can actually deep down and tell you what they don't know about themselves. The killer question's often hidden from view. It's that question which is 5 years out that you need to unpack. It's not the one that you actually get given. So what happens with most clients is that they'll provide you the question that they think is the question that needs answering. And it's not that it's wrong, it's just that it's not that right. And the reason is they don't have the time or the bandwidth to actually unpack it. They're so close to the problem that they can't see the wood for the trees. And we all suffer from it. When we're in our own organisations, you have this filter over it which you can't get away from. So it's not saying that clients are stupid or anything like that, it's just that they have this big day job, and they're scheduled from morning to night to try and do that day job. And then what they try to do is unpack what the problem is for you. And they do a really good job of it. But our job is to actually take that further, to actually understand the question behind the question. Every one of your competitors is asking the same question. How do we create a great experience that differentiates and do it in a differentiated way? And if you think about telcos, I mean, you know, if one of the things was how do you create a great experience in store, they go, well, we've got to, you know, create great music. Then it just gets down to a battle of music and who's playing MGMT and who's playing Celine Dion. I mean, then it gets down to a battle of execution. That's not transforming. That's just incremental. We believe there are three ways, or three layers to actually unpacking and answering business challenges. What is the problem? Why is this a problem? And how should we solve this problem? At the what level, you're asking, what is the problem? What does the customer like and dislike? What is their preferred channel? But this just operates at a surface level. This is where traditional market research operates. It doesn't go deep, it doesn't go behind the meaning for what you're actually, the deeper motivations and drivers you're actually looking for. Here's a good example. This is off the Pizza Hut Facebook page. What's your favourite way to enjoy Pizza Hut? Hot and fresh, a few hours later, the next morning, dine in. I just don't understand what value that creates. I just don't understand why you were Pizza Hut, you would put that up. What are you going to do with that? Guess what? Most people like it hot and fresh. Some people dine in. 1% like it the next morning when they're hungover. And a few people might have it a few hours later if they're pigs. I mean, I don't know what you do with that. But that's just an example. I know it's on a Facebook page where there are all these market research companies and companies asking questions like this. They're asking you at the what level. It doesn't tap into that much richer vein of why. Why do you like it hot and fresh? Or why do you like to dine in? Why do you want to do that? Why is that important to you? How does that help you in your life? Why unveils and uncovers a whole raft of new, deeper, richer meaning. Why does this concern you? Why does it make you feel this way? Why is this valuable to you? Why is it not valuable to you? Asking more why questions help you unpack what the deeper motivations and drives of customers and organisations are. This works on two levels. You should be asking your organisations that you work with, you're a service designer, why? Why do you actually want to solve this? Why is it important? What is going to be the outcome? Why would you want to achieve this? Why will the organisation be better off? Why will this benefit you? If you look on the left-hand side here, you'll see a whole bunch of market research things. You know, what is market research? Well, it's scripted, it's broad, it weighs the outliers, you know, it's verbal, yields consumer data, and that's all well and good. But most organisations have a plethora of traditional market research. They are not short of market research. Every time we work for a company, we ask them for it, and it comes in droves. They've got bucket loads of it. They don't need that much more. Service design research on the other side, which you'd be all familiar with, is improvisational. I didn't even say that right, but I can't even say it. But you can read it. Gathers specific anecdotes. It loves the outliers. Sometimes, you know, you can have those one-hour interviews where you're talking with somebody and you're just going through and you're asking them questions, you're asking why, and nothing's coming out. And then 55 minutes in, you get gold. They just give you that one sentence that unpacks the whole meaning for what the problem is. Because you've done 20 other interviews and you've done other research data, but that thing brings it to life for you. In traditional market research, they don't buy that. That's not quantitative. You can't go back and say, listen, I just spoke to this one person and they said this was the thing. But you know intuitively, absolutely, it's right. The job then is to go get the other data to back it up. And so you do these types of things. Customer interviews, shadowing, discovery workshops. You're all familiar with that type of stuff. And the reason that you do that is that people do not always do what you think they do. People do not always do what you tell them to do. People do not always do what they think they do. People do not always do what they say they do. Asking why lets you find out what people really do and really need. Because they just don't understand themselves. You can't ask a person why they prefer product A over product B. They just don't understand at a level which they can actually tell you. It's not explicit to them. Our job is to try and understand and make it explicit. And we need to provide organisations and customers a perspective on this. One tool which Eric's developed, we work with, is a thing called 7 Days of My Life. And this is the only tool I'm going to talk about today for a couple of minutes. But I think it's really interesting because it's like a cultural probe, but I think it's better. It's like an online diary, but I think it's better. What you do is you, with all the research that you've done, you understand what the sort of general themes or areas that you want to understand customers in. And then you'd set up 7 different themes over 7 different days. And customers at home, online, they fill it out and they upload images and pictures and icons and copy and they answer this for you. And what it allows them to do is tap into their deeper motivations and needs because it's a really safe environment. But you're not asking them direct questions, you're asking them about the context of their life. You're not asking them, why do you like a phone? You're asking, tell me about community. Why is community important to you? Why is having friends important to you? Tell me about control. What does control mean for you? Tell me about fairness. When did you feel like you've been treated fairly? When did you feel like you were treated unfairly? How did that make you feel? And why? You ask these types of questions, and then you put it up on the wall, it looks beautiful. But what's really interesting for something like that is the intensity of the language gives you a clue. So what we've uncovered is that when people are using these highly emotive words, and 7 Days of My Life helps you unpack that, they will use highly emotive words. An example from a couple of years ago, we were asking women about the spa experience, and we were asking them about friends and community and whatnot. And we're talking about confidence. That's right, we're asking them about confidence. And then one woman was relating to when she goes to school to drop off the kids, and she sees other women look sideways at her. And she starts to question herself, and she starts to question her confidence. And she said, I don't think I'll ever stop being that 15-year-old schoolgirl that was teased at school. And it's stuff like that which is really raw. Other times we've asked people questions about what's important to them, and they go, what are you scared of? I'm scared of my husband leaving me. I'm scared of getting fat. I'm scared of being unattractive, my husband leaving me and not having anybody. I mean, this is really raw stuff that when you start digging deeper in, really unpacks things for you. So it's important to understand why and understand the context. What we also do is we ask our stakeholders to do the same. So we've asked customers about fairness and control or simplicity, That's our client at Virgin, Amanda. We'll ask them to go through the same process. And why do we do that? Because what happens is you bring them back in afterwards and they see what their customers have said, and then they go, wait on, they said what I just wrote. Therefore, it must be right. It's a wonderful tool for them, for you as a service designer, to help convince your client that what you're doing is actually right, because they're saying exactly the same thing, because guess what? They're humans. They're not answering as the head of customer experience or the retention manager or the acquisition manager. They're answering as a human, just like your customers are human. And they empathise with you. And then they come in and they go, guess what? Wow, control isn't actually what we thought it was about. When we work with Virgin, when they came to us and we said, control's really important. We think customers want to control their phone plans. And at the time, they had 20 phone plans. And what they were about to do was move to unlimited phone plans. You were going to be able to change the dial however you liked. 34 SMSs, you know, 77.6 minutes of voice, you know, 2.37 gigs of data. You could have whatever you like, because they believed the customers wanted control. We went through this process and unpacked control and found out, no, that's not what it is at all. Control is about control of your life. Control isn't about more choices. Control doesn't equal choice. Control is help me put myself back in control of my life. That's what it's about. And so by multiplying everything, that's just adding complexity. They actually want you to simplify it. They would have stuffed the whole thing. So what have they done? They've halved from 19 plans to 9, and now they're trying to head to 5. Because they understand that customers just give me 5 plans, and then once I've got it, help me deal with it or manage it in a way that I can control and get on with my life. Because guess what? Managing a phone plan is not important to me. We talked about working with not only understanding the question behind the question or the problem behind the problem for customers, but for working with your client organisations. This is the question that Virgin asked us when they first engaged us last year. What we ended up with was, how do we install the internal processes and capabilities and behaviours that will guarantee that we'll be able to predictably deliver this customer experience? Anybody can design a great customer experience, okay? Maybe not anybody, but lots of people. Designing the great customer experience isn't the problem. We can all go through and understand customers. Delivering it is the thing that creates value. Developing lots of ideal customer journeys doesn't create a scrap of value. It creates zero value because nothing's happened. It has to get implemented. It has to get executed. And if it doesn't happen, there is no value created. We've just spent a whole lot of time and resource and money developing all this stuff. We have to execute it. So then it gets to how. How do you solve this problem? Well, traditionally, we'll do things like this, and I'm not going to dwell on it. We'll develop personas. And then we'll do map ideal customer journeys. And then we'll do defining service principles. And out of all that, we'll have lots of ideas and initiatives and all that type of thing. So this is what we do. This is what we do in service design. But this is where the majority of service design stops. This is only half of what clients are looking for. They're actually looking for execution. They're actually looking for value creation. For us, this is where value creation really starts. It's important to go to spend that 3 months doing the co-creation, the staff interviews, the desktop research, the context mapping, the 7 days of my life, the shadowing and observation. We do all that. That's really important. We spend 3 months, 3 or 4 months doing it. Absolutely super, super important. I love it. It's super exciting. But then there's more. Because once you've done all that, you need to make a robust case to the business guys to how you're going to get further investment. Because guess what? What they're doing is evaluating that investment against a lean approach, or a sales approach, or a human services change management approach, or sales training approach. It's just a bucket of money which has to be split up. And what the bean count, he doesn't care. He just wants return on investment. He doesn't care whether we do customer experience or not. He doesn't care whether we do sales training or not. But he's the guy or girl actually holds the purse strings. And if you can't convince them, nothing happens. There's actually value dilution because you've invested $100,000 or $200,000 and nothing happened. So we do a Net Promoter Score. Hands up who's familiar with Net Promoter Score? Okay, about a third of the audience. It's a customer loyalty metric. It was developed by Bain & Co. It's very simple. It only asks three questions. Would you recommend this product, this service, to a friend or colleague? Score from 0 to 10. If you score from 9 and 10, you're a promoter. If you score 7 or 8, you're considered a fence sitter. You don't care. And you know what it's like yourself. When you're asked a research question, they go, how did you like it? You go, it's about 7. You know, I wasn't committed in. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it either. So it's like called this fence sitter. And then 0 to 6 are called detractors. And what you do is you research 100 or 1,000 people and you ask them all this same question, and then you add up the number that do 9 and 10, you ignore the 7 or 8s, and then you take away this 0 to 6. It's a scale from plus 100. If everyone actually answered 9 or 10, you'd get 100. And to give you context, Apple scores 79, BMW scores 62, banks score about minus 10. Because if everything's 0 to 6, it's minus 100, so it's a 200-point scale. Telcos score around 0. Varies. But you can use all this data to actually unpack it. The second question is, why did they ask this? Why did you answer this way? And the third question is, what's the one thing that we could do to improve this? Now, Net Promoter Score isn't by itself all that's needed. It's just a little part of it. But what it allows you to do is ask a fourth question is, would you be open to a follow-up phone call? Which gives you access to 10, 15, half an hour phone call of these people, and you've got the data as to what they said. So you can ring up and actually say, I saw you said this. That's really interesting. Have you got 10 minutes to talk to me about it? Rather than, hi, I'm here from AMR Quantum Research, and I've got 30 questions which are going to bore the crap out of you. Have you got 30 minutes? No. So you do that. You go work with the business intelligence people. You go through tenure, spend, all that type of stuff. You start crunching stuff. You understand likelihood to promote. This is where all the customer research, design research happens. And then you do bucket loads of analysis. And then what we do is we look and work through it. I haven't got time to talk about all this type of stuff here, but how do you translate? What I'm trying to show you is we've already done 3 or 4 months of customer research and insight and ideal mapping. Then we do all this work in actually translating themes into the customer corridor. And then valuing them and working out how we're going to roll them out. And then allocating how improvements, again, customer experience is going to be, the customer satisfaction. How do you improve customer satisfaction in particular areas? How do you actually understand advocacy? How do you understand tenure? And then you end up with an NPV. And you can give that to the CFO and you go, okay, we're going to deliver X million dollars of return if you put that investment in. They go, thank you very much. Sign the check, let's go. So lifetime value is about customer data versus business intelligence data plus understanding customers times a bucket load of analysis. That's how you get lifetime value. And when you do that type of stuff, you find out that raving fans are nearly worth 4 times more than detractors. So people who score 9 and 10 are worth physically, money-wise, 4 times more than detractors. So if you can move more people from the middle bucket to the top bucket, they're far more valuable. And that's how you build a business case, and that's how you get it funded. Second thing I want to talk about today is jobs. Also, I want to talk about measuring value. 2 questions you can ask to improve value created. What does the customer value from us, and how well are we doing at delivering it? So if you ask that, what I've done is try to simplify this and said, okay, imagine there's only 3 touch points. For the first touch point, how does the customer value? What does the customer value from us? We're getting a 7 out of 10. I value that from you, 7 out of 10. From the second one, we only value that 3 out of 10. I know you provide me that newsletter, but I don't give a shit. 8 out of 10, yep, I actually like simplified plans. That's really cool. And then you say, well, how well are we doing at delivering it? A, well, you're only doing 3 out of 10. Here, you're doing a pretty good job over there. Not a bad job. The options then are, you close the gap on the first one, you ignore the second one, because why focus on something I don't value? And the third one is you increase the focus, because it's important. You're doing a good job, but you can create more value. And just by doing a simple arithmetic, 7 times 0.3, you end up with 2.1 units of value. So you can multiply that across. So you can quantify the value, okay? This is a very simplified example. But you've now quantified the value that you've created. And you know that if you want to improve it, just say you want to get to 8 or 9 out of 10. Again, by simple arithmetic, 7 times 0.9 equals 6.3. So you started with 10.1 units of value. You've now got 15.9 units of value. It's just a way, and there's lots deeper, but I'm just trying to make the example of how do you quantify value? Because everyone's asking the question, I can't prove it. Well, this is one way of proving it. And it's not bad. You might get it like that. Based on that, it's a 60% increase. But what if there was another way to add additional value? What if there was another way to actually add more value? We just used the service offering as the current unit of analysis. We were focused on the service offering, what we were offering. How do we go about improving that service? But what if the job was the primary unit of analysis? What is a job? A job is the fundamental problem a customer needs to resolve in a given situation. It's the problem they're trying to get solved. And so you ask, what if a customer needs didn't just relate to the service itself? What if there were more needs? There were customer needs and there were job needs. Let me bring this to life. I want to tell you a story about a thick shake. The story goes like this, that a fast food organisation was looking to improve the sale of their thick shakes. They took it to the marketers, they segmented the business, the category, they worked out who their key target was, and they asked them if they wanted more chocolatey, do they want it thicker, would they like more stuff in it, what could they do? Well, guess what? They did all that type of stuff. They answered everything the customer wanted and nothing happened. Sales didn't change. So then they engaged another research company to come in. And what the research company did was it sat in the restaurant and actually watched what people did. And what they found out was that 40% of the people who bought these thick shakes came in alone. They didn't come in with anyone else. They came in alone. They didn't buy anything else. And then they walked out the door again. So they thought, this is really interesting. So the next day they came back and they said, they watched these people and they went to these people who were doing this, buying these thick shakes, coming in alone, not buying anything else and walking out. And they said to them in a sort of way which they understand, excuse me, Mr. Customer, what's the job that you're hiring this thick shake to do? What are you hiring this thick shake to do for you? And as it turned out, what these people were hiring the thick shake to do, the job that it was doing, was they were facing a really boring commute. They had a long commute into work, and what they were looking was for something to keep him occupied for as long as possible, to occupy that left hand, so they reduced the boredom of their commute. They were in work clothes, so they needed something that was easy and clean. Now, they know they didn't need a thick shake then, but they knew that they'd be hungry by 10 o'clock. But they knew if they drank this, they'd be good to 12 o'clock. They'd be good through to lunch. They also knew if they drank this thick shake that it was kept them occupied. But it was unlike a bagel or a donut or toast or something like that, which is sticky and awful. Banana, that goes in about 2 minutes, so that's gone. That doesn't get you the 20 minutes. Drinking a thick shake lasts 20, 25 minutes. Thin straw, viscous. The job of the thick shake was to reduce boredom. Now, if you understand the job of that as reducing boredom, then you open yourself up to a whole new world. How do you reduce, what do we do to reduce boredom? So let's go about an example. Annabelle Citizen, very well-known person at ANZ. These are the things on an ANZ credit, any credit card. Low interest rates, fraud protection, wanted to be accepted, loyalty points. These are the things which credit cards compete on. Interest-free days. Okay, these are the customer needs. But the job of a credit card is to make purchases. That's the job of a credit card. It's actually to make purchases. It's not about loyalty points. It's not about interest-free days. It's about making purchases. It's about buying things. So it's about finding desired. If you think about purchases, making purchases, that's about finding desired products, comparing brands to buy, tracking expenditure, purchasing it easier and quicker. That's about purchasing. They're the jobs which are connected to making purchases. So when you use the job as a filter, a whole new world opens up for you. Whole new customer needs are actually opened up. Things like, I have trouble finding exactly what I want. Help me find the product that I actually want because I'm about purchases. I'm not sure which is the best brand to buy. I'm not very good at tracking what I spend. I wish there was a way that I could pay quicker in more places. They're the needs of jobs. And if you're a bank, you've got all this data, and then you combine it with job needs, you've got all this new value. this new value area that you can look at. It's customer value, it's organisational value. So let's bring that to life. Imagine if you started developing ideas or products which were a digital manual for products you buy. Because we buy lots of stuff. And everybody has the problem when you get that manual at home, you go, do I keep it? Do I chuck it? What do I do with it? Do I put in that bloody thing that I can't find? But what if there was a place that you could put a code in and there was a product which actually held all your digital manuals for you and the bank provided it for you? Wouldn't that be really cool? What if there was a warranty app? Again, there's all these warranties and all that type of stuff. Imagine there's a way that you actually keep all the warranties digitally, you know, secured, so when you actually had a problem you needed on that warranty, you could access it. What if there was a self-service scanner, so when you go into Kmart and Target, you know how you scan stuff? I go into Target, I got little kids. You go to Target, you scan stuff, it gave you actually customer ratings at the same time. Wouldn't that be actually helpful in wondering whether to make that purchase or not? What if you were, when you were travelling, there was an app to actually help you monitor your spending? You know that company Shoebox, where you actually pack up all your receipts, put it in a shoebox, and you send it off to them, they scan it and encode it and put it into your P&L. Brilliant. But what if there's a link to something like that? So imagine if you had all these apps, all these ideas. So this is what we had before. We created 15, we've gone from 10.9 to 15.9. Imagine we created these new ideas. And imagine they delivered value of 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10, and that was how you delivered it. Well, what would happen? Well, suddenly you've created 21 units of new value out of nothing, because you weren't looking there before, you're looking there now. You've got 37.6 units of value when you started with 10. Traditional way of looking at customer needs, you've got 60% increase. This way, you've got 270% increase. You've opened yourself up to a whole new world of value. Third thing I want to talk about today is reducing complexity. I read an article recently, it was called The Death of Complexity. Some of you might have read it. And I was saying that people want all the features and cool stuff. They just don't want to be hassled with the complexity of dealing with it. They want it when they want it, but when they don't want it, they want it sort of put to the side. So complexity is something, a real issue for us as we move into this next decade. I mean, I don't think there'll be anybody who works in an organisation that hasn't been in a meeting where somebody said, hey, can we do it on iPad? Let's introduce a mobile app. Can we do it on iPhone? Yeah, let's do it on iPhone. Hey, let's connect on Facebook. That would be cool. That's another way to get social media. Wow, let's do it. It's really important. We've got to be there. Let's connect on Facebook. How about we update them by SMS on their order? Another touch point, let them do all that type of stuff. They need that. Can they pay by phone? If you think back to banks, you know, 40 years ago, they were pretty simple things. The ecosystem sort of looked like this. You could go into the teller, you could go to an ATM, or you could do it by phone. That was the ecosystem in banking, 1980. This is the ecosystem now. You can do it via Australia Post, or all these different third-party apps, third-party services, phone, internet, iPad, all these different ways. But customers expect a seamless transfer. They expect a seamless experience. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. What's not apparent for organisations is that the effort required to actually deliver this is logarithmic. It's easy to introduce that, but what you've got is 10 different departments trying to deliver all these types of things. They're all working independently. They're not thinking from a customer point of view. They're all working independently to launch all these types of things, and therefore they've got different levels of information. Some allow you to print out statements, some don't. Some allow you to transfer funds, some don't. But customers don't think like that. They go, oh, why can't I just have this seamless way of getting through? 10% of the problem or of the effort is developing the new app. 90% of the creation of value is actually implementing in a seamless and consistent integration, so it actually delivers value. Customers expect organisations to be intelligent. And sometimes maybe it's just better to actually rein back some of those new channels for delivery and actually get the ones that you've got working really, really well. Make it seamless and consistent. The last thing I want to talk about briefly is keeping promises. When you look at most interactions, and I'll take a phone company or banking, most interactions happen at the beginning. So when you're engaging or signing up for a contract, lots of engagement, lots of interaction. But then for the next sort of 22 months, they sort of ignore you. But the money, the value being created, goes throughout that 24 months. So, but when they focus here, it's sort of an up and down type of customer experience. Even though the money's coming, over the value's being created over 24 months, but the focus of their effort is on the first sort of 10%. Wouldn't it make more sense if they actually interacted with you throughout the 24 months in a way that created value for you, which reflected when the value that you were generating for them was actually being delivered to you, and it would actually increase the customer experience? This is how we make promises. We don't need more promises. Companies are very good at making promises. Excellent. And this is how we make promises. We cover anybody who drives your car. Big promise. I don't know if they deliver it, but it's a big promise. Optus, 4 months free broadband access, no access usage fees, come to the fine tape, there are access usage fees. We kill the asterisk. Wow, what a big bloody, you know, wow. No monthly fees ever. No conditions ever. Okay, great. I'm looking forward to them delivering that. But that is an enormous promise. How your promises, this is how promises are kept when people buy your products, use your products, go into a store, negotiate the bill, negotiate the IVR, talk to your call center. That's how promises are made. There's a large gap that exists between promises made and promises kept. You've probably seen this before. Graphics by Brandon, data by Bain. You know, 80% of companies believe they deliver a superior experience. When they ask the same set of customers, only 8% agree. The reason for that, there's three types of gaps. There's the expectation gap, there's the brand gap, there's the delivery gap. The expectation gap is not about designing services to meet customer expectations. Okay? I expected this, you sort of indicated that, I didn't get that. A brand gap, failing to match the performances to brand communications. Talk to the techsperts. That's a good line, I like that. But when I walk in there, I have a brand expectation that everyone I talk to in Dick Smith is an absolute technical expert and acts like a genius. And can you deliver that? Delivery gap, last example. Not performing the service of design. This is ING Direct, live chat. I could see the live chat icon before, but now I can't. Why is that? Well, our live chat functionality will be available unavailable outside of business hours. Isn't that the point? I'd just pick up the phone if it was in during business hours. This is where the customer experience opportunity is. It's about creating value for organisations. It's about creating value for customers. It's about creating expanding value and creating expanding customer experience. We look at our world this way. This is how we, you know, discover, design, develop, deliver. Some people have define in there. It doesn't matter if you've got 5Ds, 6Ds or 4Ds or you've got something else. This is the process. And we see that our job, and we explain this to our clients, is our job sort of is this blue area. So when we're in discover, heaps of it and a little bit of you, and it dissipates as we go through. Our client's job starts increasing as we go through to deliver. What this represents is value. Some value is created there, not lots. More, most. It's important to understand where value is created. It's also important to understand where the role of design is important and where the role of commercial strategy is important. It's the same thing. Just in keeping, we believe branding is the promise you make. Customer experience is the promise you keep. Thank you very much.
We hope you liked this presentation from Service Design 2012. For more presentations from this and other conferences, please visit uxaustralia.com.au.